Get your gear ready. This is a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation.
It's another episode of a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation, a podcast dedicated to guiding you along your innovation expedition. I'm Ben Tingey, host Sherpa. Sherpa Jay Gerhardt joins me in the studio. Buenos dias.
Hello, Ben.
Benjamin Franklin said, "An investment in knowledge pays the best interest." Here to tell us about the value of making wise education choices throughout our lives is Michael B. Horn, Chief Strategy Officer for the Entangled Group and Education Technology Studio, and a Senior Partner for Entangled Solutions, which offers innovation services to higher education institutions. Michael is also the co-founder of and a distinguished fellow at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation, an institution that we highly admire. He's an expert on disruptive innovation, online learning, blended learning, competency-based learning, and how to transform the education system into a student-centered one. He's authored several books, including Disrupting Class, How Disruptive Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns with Clayton Christensen, and the Amazon bestseller, Blended, Using Disruptive Innovation to Improve Schools. He also has a podcast entitled Future You in partnership with his co-host, Jeff Salingo. But most recently, Michael co-authored Choosing College, How to Make Better Learning Decisions Throughout Your Life with Bob Mesta, which will be the focus of our conversation today. With that introduction, welcome, Michael, to a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I think you left one thing off my bio, which is that I might be an expert in buzzwords as well from that boundary. No. I appreciate it.
I'm just impressed by the number of different types of learning. I didn't even know there were that many.
Exactly. Hence the buzzword craze, I suppose.
That's all right. It's good for search engine optimization, I guess. Awesome. Well, it's a privilege to speak with you today, and thank you so much for joining us. A quick note to our listeners, if this is your first exposure to jobs to be done theory, or if you need a refresher, you may find value in listening to episodes 8 and 9 of our podcast. Additionally, we had a great conversation with Michael's co-author, Bob Mesta, in episode 52 that we'd recommend listening to as well if you haven't already. But let's get started. Michael, are you ready?
Let's do it.
Okay, Michael, fill in the blank for us. I wanted to be a blank when I grew up. Now I'm a blank, and they both blank.
Yeah, so I wanted to be an astronaut when I grew up. I was obsessed with space and stars and constantly reading books about the constellations and so forth. I have no idea what you would call me now. You all prepped me for this question, and I have no idea. I guess I'm a writer, speaker, consultant, something like that. What I think they both have in common is the curiosity about how the world works so that you can use those ideas to improve our lives for all of humanity.
Great. I like that connection. Nice. Curiosity. Absolutely. Well, Michael, give us the origin story behind choosing college and using the jobs to be done parlance. What was the first thought and what were some of the dominoes that fell for you and Bob that made you want to actually sit down and write this book?
Yeah, so the first thought was one that we'd been having at the Christensen Institute over and over again. And one of my colleagues, Michelle Wise, and I were talking about this hypothesis we had that Clay and I had talked about as well, frankly, that colleges and universities were being hired to do lots of different jobs. So students were coming to them with lots of reasons for why they were going there, lots of different contexts and situations. And as a result, our theory was colleges were suboptimal for everyone because they were trying to cater to, you know, every single one out there. And so they were effectively a one-size-fits-none service. And as a result of that, we thought, well, if we could understand the jobs that students really have when they come to them, then we could help colleges optimize and be much more tailored for these different jobs and lower costs and so forth. As we dug into the research and we did the interviews and we did the analysis and so forth, frankly, two things happened. One, the stories were so interesting and compelling in their own right that it just felt like you had to get this out there to help people be able to see themselves in the stories to know that they weren't alone. And then the second thing was that the analysis, the jobs to be done themselves that emerged, and then the advice and guardrails that stem from what we discovered, we felt like we have to write that into a book to help parents and students make better decisions. we just couldn't hold that back. And so it started with, you know, the supply side, as Bob would talk about it, trying to help colleges and universities. And then the data and the stories and the information was just so interesting that we felt like, gosh, there's a book here. And I was so excited to write with Bob because obviously he's been the guru of jobs to be done for a couple decades now. But interestingly enough, despite all the writing about jobs to be done, Bob had never been the author of a book on it. And I said, we've got to do this together. You've been instrumental to this process. Let's do this together and get the word out.
And what an awesome partner in crime for the interviews. Did you get to participate with Bob in some of the interviews?
Oh, yeah. It's fun doing interviews with Bob. It's very hard to get a word in edgewise, as you all know, because Bob sucks up the oxygen in a room in a very compelling way, and he's so good at them. It was really neat. We also had some research, a research fellow at the Christensen Institute, Audrey, who did a ton of interviews on her own. So there was a good mix of folks that participated in this project, which was super fun because sometimes the question you get is, well, what about bias in the jobs to be done interview? And you all know the way Bob approaches interviews, he sort of cuts through bias by just putting on this total naive face, if you will, of like, I don't know anything about your industry. I don't know anything about what you're dealing with. Let me just ask the most basic questions and get you to talk at me so I can see the movie of what actually happened. But people worry about this. And so having multiple people do lots of different interviews, super helpful in just understanding context from a variety of perspectives.
Yeah. And the book is a great way to really demonstrate that this type of qualitative research and the stories you can get out of it. But, you know, you really do come at these with a beginner's mindset. If done properly, there shouldn't be bias because you're not coming in with a script. You're not coming in with an agenda other than simply hearing the stories and the language of the person that you're talking to.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you did that with Bob when you were doing the interview around, you know, what grad school, right, did you hire? And I could hear you probably know some of the story already in some cases, but the ability to step back and ask what might seem like an obvious question and therefore not worth asking, but it's almost always worth asking, right? Yeah. It's an obvious question, but you actually don't know the answer to it. It's always worth asking, and just keep that why focus, right? Keep digging in beneath the surface so you don't just settle for a surface level explanation.
Yeah, that's really good lessons for anyone doing consumer research for really any purposes. Well, we'll stick with the jobs lingo a little bit and ask you why someone should hire this book. Maybe talk about some key pushes and pulls and maybe hit it from two different perspectives, one of the high school student and two, maybe that lifelong learner.
Yeah, totally. So if you're a high school student or you're the parent of a high school student and you're feeling a struggle or angst, right, around what's next in your life, high school is going away and you're either not sure if college is right for you, period, or you're not sure which college to choose and you sort of feel like you're caught up in the rat race that society is constructed around, well, you got to go to college next. It's obviously the next step or, you know, those sorts of social pressures. And you're feeling that struggle acutely. Then I think this book is super useful because it's going to help you step back from all that and realize, hey, a lot of advice out there focuses on how do you apply and which schools and the list of the rankings of schools and things like this. But this book is going to step back and situate it in your struggle to help you see where you are. In some ways, it makes the unconscious struggle that you're experiencing right now conscious so you can say, oh, yeah, that's what I'm going through right now. And therefore, here are some guardrails or advice that will allow me to broaden my options and see things that I never otherwise could have imagined as what I might do next and choose accordingly. If you're a lifelong learner, I think, frankly, it's a very similar thing. If you're feeling a struggle around feeling that you need more education, or I would add, if you're trapped right now in your current job and you're sort of looking for an escape from it, so the struggle is not necessarily what you think is around education, but you're sort of like, where I am right now is not all I could be, or I've always been longing to do something more, and you're feeling some angst or struggle or conflict around that, then I think this book can be super helpful. I will be very candid on your podcast and say, going through writing this book in my own career, I hit a couple crossroads while writing the book where I got offers for some interesting jobs, lowercase jobs, and being able to frame it through the book, the language through the book, and say, hey, actually, right now I'm here, not there. It allowed me to make, I think, much more informed decisions that were in keeping with the progress that I was seeking to make.
Bob talks about all the time is his desire to make us all better consumers. And so in this case, mm-hmm. education choices, and in your case, what you just talked about, career choices. So I think, and you also talked about making the unconscious conscious. Though I think the way that I've heard Bob say it is making the implicit explicit. But I love how this book, as you read through it and you understand the context and the progress of the jobs that are articulated, you really, it's so easy to put yourself in those situations and see, okay, what are the pushes and pulls that I'm feeling and why do I want to make that particular choice? And what's also really interesting is that it's not just about college. And that's why I think readers or listeners, as they learn about the book, may get hung up, but I think they'll, once they get into it, they'll realize that college is not always the answer and that there are lots of other choices depending on the progress that you're seeking that may much better fulfill your intended progress. And
yeah, education can take many forms. And I think it, I can't remember if it's in the acknowledgement sections or one of the later chapters where I think you talked about conversation with Bob, where Bob talked about some of your learning objectives at your point in life, where hiring a podcast or a book or something like that is a way of learning, and that fits into the context of your life. And I can totally identify with that.
Yeah. And what I would say, right, is, and I'm curious actually how you all react to this, but Bob and Clay have been so good at teaching all of us that people don't hire products or services, right? We don't go out and say, today is the day that I want a hearing aid, or today is the day that I want crutches, right? Instead, you're seeking to make progress in your life, and you pull in, you hire a given product or service to help you make progress, right? But it's the progress and the situation around it that helps you understand what you need to hire. And too often, I think, in our dialogue around college, we frame it all about college for its own sake, as opposed to the larger progress you're trying to make. And once you do the latter, you realize, well, yeah, college is one thing I could hire, but there's actually lots of other options. And college is maybe a misleading word, but you realize that actually lots of experiences in your life are educational in nature, right? And I alluded to career choices and things of that nature, learning from someone in a meeting. I mean, I learn so much from Clay or Bob when I have a meeting with them. That is clearly education, but we don't call it education. We call it a meeting. And so understanding the progress can really, I think, help you reshape your mental model, if you will, about the set of choices available to you at whatever crossroads you're in right now. I'm curious, though, like, did that resonate with you all? Did you start to see, gee, I'm in this spot right now. I was thinking, you know, this skill would be useful, but I actually get it from, you know, something totally different.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
I think if you understand the job and you understand jobs to be done, you know that there's a much wider competitive set in the choices mm-hmm. you might make. And if I take that into healthcare, for example, our products and services, well, we have, say, primary care and specialty care. And those are things we might think what people are hiring. But people are hiring things like Peloton. They're hiring YouTube videos. They're hiring a friend's mom who might be a PA and have knowledge about health and wellness. If they're seeking health, there's a very wide range of things they're going to consider. And I think that carries over exactly into what you're talking about in the book.
Yeah.
It's interesting in the healthcare example. Like, I'm a big functional medicine believer, right? I really like getting at the root cause of things and thinking about the body more holistically than just, you know, systems that are isolated from each other. And so I'm on tons of emails and podcasts about healthcare all the time and about how to think about this stuff. I get so much education and frankly, healthcare from that, from those sources that then change the decisions that I make in terms of how I sleep, in terms of how I exercise, in terms of how I eat and so forth, that have huge downstream benefits into my health and wellness that aren't just, you know, I have an acute infection, I need to go to the doctor and I need to get medicine right now. Once you start understanding that progress that you're trying to make, it really reframes, at least for me, those sets of choices that you see in front of you.
Yeah, that's a really great example. So I've heard you on another podcast talk about how the interviews surprised you as you got into them. Talk to us about what was so surprising about what you uncovered in the research and the interviews from the book.
Yeah, so Clay and I have written several articles going back years from now where we used to say things like, we can speculate that people hire college to do everything from get them a coming of age experience that helps them transition to adulthood, that helps them launch a career, that helps them switch jobs, things of that nature. And we would write that all the time. And Bob warned me when we get in this process that you never actually know the jobs until you do the research itself. It's not something you can just sort of divine from knowing the industry or what you think you know about people. You actually have to dig in and watch these quote-unquote mini documentaries of how they live their life and the switching moment, right, when they go from one set of experiences to consuming something very different. And then the jobs sort of, you know, reveal themselves. And in retrospect, you're like, oh, of course that made sense. But what's so interesting is all those ones that I just listed, and what was so surprising to me that Clay and I would always write about, none of those are the jobs that we actually found when we did the research. For sure, getting a job is sort of implicit in some of these, so we have to keep doing the lowercase job and the uppercase job, I guess. But, you know, getting a career or place of work is something that is implicit in several of these jobs that we found, but they're not the overriding or only reason for any of them. And I that was just surprising to me, because so much of the focus and conversation right now in higher education circles is on how you go to college to get, you know, to get a paying job. And that's just the purpose of college. And it's just not at all how actual students or would-be students are living their lives. And I think that's really an important finding. It was a surprising finding to me. And I think it's a telling one that I hope people take a lot away from.
Yeah. And one example that comes to mind is job number one, which is helped me get into my best school, that the progress that those people were seeking was not a job, but just admission into whatever yeah. favorite school they had. And that was basically like it.
Yeah. And I was so sure when I went to business school that I was not in that job. I was sure I was going to be in like, help me step it up. Or I would have said, help me transition industries, you know, before the research was done or something like that. And then when you go through my actual decision-making process, where I'm so clearly in help me get into my best school based on the actual decisions that I made and what I in fact prioritized. And even further evidence of that is I was in the writing world and world of policy and things of that nature before business school. And after business school, I was right back into those things, even though I thought I was trying to get away from them. That's not at all how I lived my life or made the decision. So it's just very hard to just divine these things up front. You actually got to do the research. And that one that helped me get into my best school, it just makes sense when you realize and think about all the 18-year-olds you know going to college and how little clue they have of what they want to do next or even what careers might exist out there. It's just our knowledge of what, you know, Bob would say, the unknowns greatly outnumber the knowns at that stage. And so you've got to actually do the work to start to change that equation.
Yeah. One thing I also appreciated, and I guess this comes down to a little bit of your experience of sort of hypothesizing what the jobs might be, but then after the research you validated what they actually are. I love how in the book you and Bob say, we wanted to name this job da 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 da, but that's not the language that we heard people using. And so yeah. we followed their language instead. And I love that deference, I guess, to the people that you interviewed and their experience, and not trying to reframe it in a, I don't know, kind of an academic or a
supply side.
It's supply side, exactly. Yeah, it's the discipline of staying on the demand side. I think that's important.
It's similar to healthcare, where healthcare institutions have their lingo, their language, their acronyms. I'm sure that institutions of higher learning have all of their language and ways of saying things as well. So it's instructive to get them to do that reframe into the consumer's state of mind.
Yeah, and if I could give your listeners two pieces of advice from what I learned through this process, or cemented for me through this process. One is, I see so many companies and so many industries say, well, of course we know the jobs to be done, right? Until you do the interviews, I will tell you, you do not know them. And it doesn't matter what market research or how close you think you are to it. You really got to do the work to see the jobs themselves. And it can only be a few interviews, right? Bob talks about this all the time. 8 to 10 interviews will give you a ton of information. The second thing I would say is that language point that you were making is, don't focus so much on the language of what you call the job, but it's really the language of the pushes and pulls that that add up to the job, that cause someone to switch. That's where it's really important to understand. In some ways, help me get into my best school. We could have gone 20 different directions than what we named it. And in some ways, the name is actually a problem, because now everyone anchors on the word best and they think, oh, U.S. News and World Report rankings. But when you look at the forces underlying it, that just gives you so much more information from someone in industry who's designing around what's actually important and what's the situation someone's in that causes them to switch, and how can we be part of that switch that helps them make progress. Really focus on the language of those pushes and pulls.
Yeah.
But it really does take some humility at the beginning of the process to go into it with a beginner's mindset and not assume you know the jobs. And again, I heard you on a podcast where you spoke at a conference, and it sounded like there was some level of skepticism about jobs and, you know, comparing it to milkshakes. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what do you hear when you hear institutions who they're not quite sure this is the way to look at it? What is it that they say?
Yeah, it's so interesting to me. And actually, we haven't been leading with the milkshake story that much. I think part of it is Bob's sick of it.
Yeah. Go to the Snickers and Milky Way example or something
I love the Snickers and Milky Way one, by the way. But I think no industry wants to think that they're not unique and that they always want to stand out. And I think in higher education, what's so interesting in some of the audiences I've spoken to, they're so wrapped up in the supply side and what they frame up as the problem and the social mission and construct that they frame higher education as existing in. And so they're sort of like, well, it couldn't possibly be the case that students don't want to go for this reason, or it couldn't possibly be the case that college isn't an answer for all these students, or things like that. And sort of that lack of imagination or understanding or empathy of the actual situation that someone's in, and a very needs-based thinking is what I would say. Needs are always present in someone's life, but the context, the circumstance someone's in, helps you understand what they're prioritizing at that given point in time. And if you don't understand that, you're just going to throw a lot of things at people that actually don't help them make progress, and they're going to tune out from them. They're going to drop out or whatever else, and it's going to cause a whole other set of problems that we certainly see with colleges and universities in this country. But it's almost like people just want to willfully ignore that and sort of push back on the methodology. The other piece you obviously see is people are always super skeptical on the N size question. We ended up having like 240 or 50 interviews for the or different stories for the book, but they're always like, well, that can't possibly be enough. My data set of 10,000 responses is way more valid, and they just don't understand the depth of actually understanding an N of one. You always say if you really want to understand how a system works, just follow one particular component right through the entire system, and that's what these interviews actually allow you to do. And people just, I think our obsession as a society with big data gets in the way of people thinking of that as a valid piece of research, rather than realizing the symbiotic nature of both sides of this.
Exactly.
Here.
And you had an unusual number of jobs interviews for this. I mean, the reality is
totally,
you can probably get it with between 15 and 20. And you did follow it up with quantitative research.
Yeah, I would hate people to leave this and think like, oh, well, gosh, 200 interviews, that's like overwhelming. Shouldn't do this. This was a unique project. I mean, we were also studying across everything from community colleges to coding boot camps to online universities to state public universities, right? I mean, huge span, A. And B, we were walking into an academic audience that was going to be skeptical, right, of a small end size. So in some ways, I would say we goosed it up thinking that was important. Now, you know, what our end size doesn't allow us to do is say, okay, how does this apply to the general population at the time that they're choosing, you know, which job is more or less present? You know, we can't answer that today, at least from our research, but it's something we could answer next with a larger end size study. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, let's think about longer term impact. Let's say 5 years from now, you're looking back and the book has exceeded your wildest expectations. What would that impact look like in terms of influence on students or higher education institutions or on society as a whole?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think you really always ought to start with that future back question, if you will, right? What's the end state? What does success look like? I think in our case, you know, primarily the first thing is we really want to see students making better choices by understanding the progress and circumstance they're actually in. And if we, our suspicion is that if they start to make better choices, we're going to see colleges and universities and higher education institutions more generally. So, you know, these coding boot camps that are emerging, online programs and the like, innovate to start serving them with better choices. So we'll start to see lower cost programs that are more efficient and get you to where you actually want to go. We'll start to see more convenient programs that actually tailor them around your life and allow you to learn and make progress you're desiring. And I think at the end of this, you would ideally see lower costs for higher education in an industry that outside of healthcare is notorious for higher costs, and much more, you know, much higher rates of success because students are making decisions that are right for them at that time, not sort of what the average should be. And institutions are designing a better set of experiences to actually match that progress students are trying to make.
That sounds like an impact that I would love to see in our society. That's great.
And for listeners who aren't as familiar with the industry of higher education, I mean, there's some real issues. I mean, we have healthcare listeners, so we know the impact of healthcare costs on consumers and crushing loads of medical debt. And, you know, we see rural hospitals closing, but there's a parallel to the higher education industry, right?
Yeah, I honestly think higher education and healthcare are extraordinarily analogous industries. And my own belief is that higher education is much closer to healthcare than it is to K-12 education, actually. So that if you want to understand how to address challenges in higher education, study healthcare and vice versa. There's just so many parallels because in many ways you have a lot of the similarities of a third party payer system in large parts of it. As you said, costs have soared in healthcare, but they've also gone up and up and up in higher education. Accrediting agencies in higher education prevent lower cost disruptive opportunities to come into the market. We've created a floor beneath which it's very hard to price higher education offerings. So it causes a lot of the prices to go up and costs follow. For better or worse, we've put in place a lot of regulations and processes and cultural legacies that discourage efficiencies and more productivity in higher education, which has caused costs to go up and up. And these services have become much more complicated and complex over the last many, many years. And so you've seen that the cost increases in higher education actually have outpaced healthcare over the last couple of decades, starting from a lower point. But the amount of student debt is actually higher than the amount of medical debt in this country. It's about $1.5 or $1.6 trillion now. And the last piece of it is, you know, to your the point about rural hospitals closing, I'm on the record as saying I think 25% of colleges and universities are in danger of closing or merging in the next 20 years. And most of those are in small rural communities because the demographics just don't support these big sprawling institutions that need to enroll certain numbers of students. They just aren't there and they're not going there. They're increasingly going to urban places where they can network into jobs and so forth. So you just, you see a lot of similarities between it. And what's so interesting, and just one last point, I, for a long time, have been saying, gee, why don't we see more employers paying for higher education for their employees to help them upskill and so forth. And one thing I took away from this book is that that actually could be a very dangerous thing if it's not aligned with the individual's job to be done, because it would create this third party payer sort of, well, I'm just getting education because someone else is telling me to do it. Help me do what's expected of me job that we found. Which has terrible success rates and really splinters, if you will, the motivation for going with who's paying, and actually could create some other problems. And it's not to say employers won't sometimes pay, but I think it's got to be really strategic, not sort of a knee-jerk benefit.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a really interesting insight. And I love all the connections to healthcare. I'm sure we could talk about that for a long time. But thinking about the book, it hasn't been out too long now. Has there been any feedback that you've received that has been particularly meaningful to you?
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of good feedback. And some of these have been at these forums where I've said, you know, people were uncomfortable with something. You know, one of them, I would say, well, I'll give you two sides of it. One that was critical feedback and one that was complimentary feedback. But the critical feedback that I think was very helpful is something we often say is that demographics do not tell you what job you're in. Right? You've probably all heard Bob say that a million times, that just because I'm a white male in a certain age bracket with a certain income level doesn't mean that I'm going to experience a certain job to be done on a given day. But where demographics are useful is the context of how you serve someone and what options they see as available to them. So if I live in a rural area with people who've only gone to college in the two colleges, say, within 75 miles of where we live, that's going to profoundly shape my experiences and what I see as my options and how I might frame my job to be done. So the job could be different, but those demographics are super helpful in understanding how to serve someone like me and what sorts of experiences I need to make progress and what I see as even a possibility in my life versus something that I just can't imagine. And it's not that I think we were ignored that. I'm curious your all response, but I think we could have given some more layers of, gee, understanding X, right? These demographics would cause you to understand, help me get into my best school in this way. Whereas if you're in this sort of set of demographics, it might spin itself very differently. I can imagine that we could have done that a little bit better. So that's one thing that I think is meaningful and something to think about more. It's not something we meant to exclude. It's just in a book, you make some choices. The second thing I'd say, frankly, Jay, your feedback on the Amazon review and what I've heard you say, incredibly meaningful, because it's exactly what we wanted. We wanted people who weren't necessarily just out of high school, but were facing any set of learning decisions, to be able to read the book and then have a conversation with someone else, as you did with your wife, about what does it mean in our lives? What did it mean then? And what does it mean going forward? That's the sort of impact we want to have, where it's not speaking to, say, the Washington bureaucrats or something, but it's really speaking to the individuals themselves as they're living their lives and helping you make better choices. And your feedback was incredibly helpful, because it felt like, yeah, that's exactly who we designed this for, and it seems like it might be resonating.
Yeah, I think the kind of conversations it can create over time will be really, really meaningful. So, yeah, I'm pleased that was helpful to you. To your first point, I do remember in the analysis of the interviews that you did, you actually did have quite a lot of representation across demographics and incomes. You know, it's not like you were focusing interviews on affluent college goers and that sort of thing. But again, it does. If you are lower income, that does add to the context. It doesn't necessarily cause you to make the choice you make, but it is significant in the context and the situation that you're in.
Yeah, but I guess I could see that criticism, but I thought the stories that you and Bob selected were very representative. I mean, in the section for job number one about your best college, all the stories didn't say that my best college is Harvard or Princeton or Yale or someplace. I mean, there were people that's like, yeah, my best is the, you know, for me and what I really want is the technical college down the street here or the state university that my family has always rooted for forever, you know, football games. And so I feel like, I don't know, I saw that what people consider their best is subjective based on their preferences, and that it's not a, you know, as you said, so tightly connected to the U.S. News and World Report rankings or something like that.
Yeah, and you got exactly what I'd hope people would out of it. And through the stories, I hope people would be able to see that variation. I guess some people wanted me to be explicit and sort of call it out, right, as Bob and I wrote it. And, you know, it's all taken in stride, right, because people often see what they want to see when they sometimes come with an agenda to these things. And ultimately, we're not trying to speak to an agenda of any stripe. We're trying to just help individuals on the ground make better choices. And then hopefully colleges and universities can pick it up and say, oh gosh, is that why they're coming to us? And then, you know, they shouldn't just take our word for it. They should do some interviews themselves and do a deep dive and figure out, oh wow, okay, you know, our flavor of it is this. And therefore, you know, let's do some prototyping and see what actually seems to help these people make better progress.
Sure, sure. So let's rewind. I think about 11 years or so, you co-wrote Disrupting Class with Clay Christensen.
Yeah.
What was the key takeaway from that book, and how does it connect or perhaps lead to choosing college 11 years later?
Yeah, great question. So the on the first one, the basic premise of Disrupting Class was that we all have different learning needs at different times in our lives. And our school system was built to standardize the way we teach and test. And how can we harness innovation to transform our K-12 education system in particular, but I would say any education system, any time we do learning, to be able to personalize for us to make progress and, you know, build our passions and fulfill our potential. What I think connects to this piece of choosing college is that over my career, over the last several years, I've looked more and more at higher education after spending a lot of time in K-12 initially. And in many ways, understanding the progress someone is trying to make introduces another layer of how do I tailor, right, to meet you where you are and help you make the progress you need to make. And a huge conclusion from choosing college that I suppose is an unexpected one as well is how do you help people develop and build passions and purpose throughout their schooling experience? And I think that goes to the heart at some point of how do you personalize also for them so that they can achieve their dreams and fulfill their human potential. That, right, that's the overall endeavor that we're in when we're in the education world, is helping people maximize what they can give to themselves and their communities, their family, their society. And I think both ultimately speak to that underlying notion of how do we help people make progress the best way we can.
Awesome. Great reflection and great connection. Any fun stories you want to share about working with Bob?
Bob is an amazing person. I will say the knockdown, drag out arguments and fights that you end up having in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, in his amazing office with his amazing colleagues, the Rewired crew, yeah, are always entertaining. And then, you know, about 4 p.m., he brings out the wine and the conversations keep going and get all that more heated. But the amount of trust that they have where they can just say what they want to say and argue something out to come to what they see, what they understand as causality, and then actually prototype against it to see, hey, was our hypothesis correct? And the ability to be honest with each other, you know, you were wrong, and no one gets upset over that. It's just learning, right? They're constantly learning. It's just tremendous. And so I guess in terms of funny stories, I will not forget some of the dinners after the conversations and arguing about what did this interview mean versus that one and so forth, of just kicking back afterwards and sort of reflecting on the broader project.
That definitely brings back some good memories. So getting close to wrapping up the podcast, we'd like to touch upon your work with Entangled Solutions. And was looking at the website. It's really intriguing. So I'm going to read a little bit. It says, we must aggressively pursue new scaled learning solutions that support all learners in acquiring and signaling the skills and capabilities they need to flourish. This imperative requires an ecosystem-wide approach that leverages the abilities of entrepreneurs, universities, foundations, companies, and government. Entangled provides an ecosystem approach to an ecosystem problem. Really interesting. Is there a particular success story from Entangled that you'd like to share that just kind of gives our listeners a sense of the work you're doing there and the impact?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And just to step back first and provide a little bit more framing, you know, it's Clay Christensen, right, who said it's not a product that disrupts an industry, it's systems of products and services working together that disrupt industries. And so that's the ecosystem approach that we feel like we need to take, where we understand the full set of actors in a system. And one success I would point to right now is an ongoing set of work that we're doing around helping to think about how do you realign education providers to actually help people make progress in their employment opportunities. And in particular, a paper that we did with Strata Education on on-ramp providers that really wrap themselves around all of the things that individuals need in their lives when they come from very trying circumstances to get that first entry-level job and crack into an industry, and all the sets of things that we're doing. And right now we're doing this process where we are literally helping actors on the ground, policymakers, foundations, and so forth, figure out through a set of three or four guiding questions, how do we build a new ecosystem that does more than just delivering learning, but wraps all of the things that someone needs around them to help them make that progress in their life. And so it's a pretty cool set of projects where we get to actually help the foundation build the strategy themselves, and then helping the actors on the ground enact it has been very rewarding.
That, again, we talk about the connections of education and healthcare, and as you're talking about that, it makes me think about the focus of social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. And when helping people make progress on their health, there's so many other things that impact it that they may need help with that we have to start to look at it, providers, and it just sounds very, very analogous to me.
Education being one of those determinants
exactly.
of health. Yeah.
Totally, right? And the interconnection, I mean, too often I think we silo healthcare and education when actually they're incredibly interlinked. I mean, healthcare determines your ability to learn, and certainly cognitive science and some of the things we've learned about memory that stems from our understanding of healthcare and how the body works impact education, and vice versa. People who have greater levels of education tend to be healthier citizens and cost certainly society less money from a healthcare perspective, but live healthier lives as well.
Yeah, well, maybe that's another impact that comes from people reading this book is better health down the road as well.
I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Michael, we are so appreciative of your time, and we've learned so much from you. Thank you for the tremendous work on the book and for all of your efforts to improve our higher education system.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I really, really appreciate it.
It's been great. A parting message to our listeners, please subscribe to and share our podcast. You can find us on LinkedIn, Medium, or on Twitter at Sherpa Pod. Let us know what you thought about this episode and then give us a rating and a review. Then follow at HealthPodNet and check out the other exceptional podcasts from the Health Podcast Network. This is Ben Tingey. Thanks so much for listening.
Look forward to seeing you tomorrow night.
Yeah, very much enjoying it. There's a lot of people from Clay World there.
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit of a Clay reunion party, I think. So hopefully that'll be fun.
Yeah.